Hey folks, I'm Courtney with Forward Montana.
And I'm Lila with Forward Montana.
And this is What the Helena. On this episode, we're diving into the narratives of Black Montanans who shaped the state, but whose legacies have long been erased. Today, we're celebrating Black History Month by uplifting their stories. Enjoy. So Lila, can you explain what the importance of celebrating Black History Month is?
Yeah. So we celebrate Black History Month as a time to celebrate and reflect on what Black folks in our communities have been able to do for us and for their own communities and for themselves, more importantly. And it centers the contributions from Black folks from around the world as it pertains to our current days and our day-to-day lives. We also see it as a way to understand the struggle for rights and freedoms and have some space and time to reflect on what it means for us in our world today. And then finally, we just take it as a space to evaluate and how we engage in celebrating and acknowledging the work that Black folks have done in our world of voter engagement, but also just in other fields.
Awesome. Thanks so much for that context. And on that note, I'm really happy to pass it off to Anthony Wood. Anthony is the author of Black Montana, Settler Colonialism and the Erosion of the Racial Frontier, 1877 to 1930. Welcome, Anthony, and I'll let you introduce yourself further.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. Courtney, Lila, it's wonderful to speak with you again. Yeah, I'm really thrilled and, you know, very honored that you thought of me for Black History Month's episode of the podcast. I've really enjoyed listening to it over the last couple of weeks. A lot of heavy shoveling has been going on here in Helena, which is, that's good podcast fuel, I find. So I'm a historian of the American West, primarily focusing on the history of racialization and minority communities as it relates to kind of these big twin themes, which I see in my work is the creation of home and belonging in our communities. And I'm largely a late 19th and early 20th century specialist. But I kind of dip my toe either side of that line. I started work on the Black history in Montana actually through the Montana Historical Society's State Preservation Office, the State Historic Preservation Office, which is here in Helena, which gave me my first, actually an internship while I was in college, and then my first job afterwards. And I was just a researcher. I was just someone who was asked to look over censuses. I was just doing grunt legwork of the historical discipline on a large Black history project, which is the most fortuitous thing that has ever happened in my career, because it's given me, I think, the beginning of a passion for telling historical stories, including ones that both are and in many ways are obviously not my own. I'm a white man. I'm from Anaconda originally, and I see myself as part of Montana's history, but engaging with a piece of it that has, for most of my life growing up, I would never would have considered to be, you know, that central to it. And man, the last 10 years have really changed my perspective on that. So My work really did begin largely in preservation, working through a big public history project. We found and cataloged the history of African Americans in Montana from the 1870s through the 1930s across the entire state. It's a really large public history project with community engagement and multiple professional historians and public historians and descendants and current residents. And it's continued on. And now I think we just last year came out with a documentary through Montana PBS. It's called Hidden Stories, Montana's Black Past, which I'm really happy with, and I've heard a lot of good responses from people who have seen it over the last year. So if you haven't seen that, you can go to, I think, Montana PBS, and PBS have it on their website. It's also on YouTube. Yes, and I, in somewhere in all of that, wrote my master's thesis and turned that into a book on Montana's Black communities from the same time period, and really trying to dig into the questions I had as a historian about how communities and places kind of create and then curate the meaning of home, like what it means to be home together, and therefore kind of the category of who belongs and why and who does not belong and how come.
Yeah, thank you. So to start off, I'm really curious, what made you become interested in writing about the lost history of Black Montanans, especially, yeah, being from Anaconda? How did you end up writing this really cool book?
Yeah, so I think Anaconda actually is where it kind of transitioned from a job and a research project that I was obviously just asked to work on into something that I knew I was going to spend hopefully years researching and then writing and rewriting. It really did come down to a couple stories, some individuals that lived in Anaconda. One man and his family, the drivers, his name was Lee Pleasant Driver. He has a great name. It's one of those kind of iconic 19th century names that we don't get anymore, where you get the full first name, middle name, and then last name kind of all just rolls off. And he owned a bar right on Main Street. Kind of Anaconda has two lights. It's on the commercial light, so going west through town, it was right there on the main intersection. And when I was doing my research with that, I came across him and his family's story. He had seven kids, and they were all phenomenally interesting. You know, they played country music and, you know, country western fiddle. One became a PhD in chemistry. Another one became the first man to get his union card with the Steelworkers Union, which obviously in Anaconda union history, it was a big way I understood the past up to this point. And there were no Black unionized workers in Anaconda, at least until Woodrow Driver, Lee Pleasant's son, got a card in late 1930s. And I was just captivated by this family whose business I drove by 10,000 times in my life, and whose home and the neighborhood of other Black Anacondans that lived around them was a space that I had spent tons of time in. Anaconda's not a terribly large place. So, I mean, I had friends that lived in the house next door to the driver's original home before they moved out of town. And I was just kind of taken aback by the kind of the word I've thought about it is erosion, but it's like there's a materiality to the history when you can stand and look at a building and know that the family that once lived there, maybe doesn't anymore, you know, has a history in your community that by a lot of rights you should be intersecting with more than we do sometimes. So that was the question that it started with the drivers in many ways, but it was all over. It was many families, many themes across the state, trying to understand how white Montanans like myself can understand and take seriously the lessons of Black history, not just for some, you know, self-actualizing, how do I think about myself, but to really critique the building of community and the places that we call home.
Awesome. Can you give us some background and context into some of the lives of the early Black Montanans that you were reading about? What were some of their stories?
Yeah, so it's good to get a little bit of a wider picture view, I think, on this, because today and for a very long time, Montana has been the least Black state, I think, in the U.S., both by the percentage of the population, but also just by total numbers pretty recently. So I think that's changing since the last census, and hopefully it just continues. But for much of the late 20th century into the 21st century, Black history has seemed really peripheral. But what's important to remember when taking that into account is that when you go back to the 1870s through the 1910s, at least, that trend was not evident. There was not a lot that would suggest to any observer at the time that Montana was not going to be home to a small but a pretty, you know, stable and thriving Black population throughout the 20th century. That changed by the 1930s, but from the 1870s through the 1910s, Montana had really the six or seven, you know, medium to large sized towns. Within each one of those was a pretty sizable Black population. The Black population was like more than 95% living in these kind of, you know, urban spaces. I mean, they're small towns, but they weren't homesteading in the countryside in very large numbers. But that meant that each of these cities kind of possessed either a Black neighborhood, sometimes in the case of Helena, multiple Black neighborhoods, in cities like Great Falls or Billings, entire, like, really, they're segregated parts of town, either through kind of de facto or de jure housing segregation, the south side of Billings and the Triangle neighborhood, that's kind of there south of the tracks, and in Great Falls, which was also the south side, interestingly, that those both became prominent Black neighborhoods. So people coming from the American South and the Northeast and Midwest, African Americans arriving in Montana at the time are very much arriving to do all kinds of jobs in kind of the booming industries of Montana's past, mining, timber, smelting. But they're also and primarily working in service sector jobs in these cities, kind of serving the needs of the community in all kinds of way. And that's largely because of discrimination. It's largely because only certain occupations are open to them once they arrive. But really, by the 1910s, we see this trend play out where, despite that type of discrimination, a number of individuals in every community are able to create kind of pretty thriving, what we would call like working middle or even, you know, solidly middle class lives, owning homes. And yeah, that's it's hard to there's a few people you could pick from each era who are really, I think, representative of what this looks like. But in general, it is good to get a sense that, you know, by the 1910s, when there's roughly 2,000 African-Americans living in Montana, that had that trend continued, or had at least that population in our various towns and cities continued, Montana would look very different today. It would be a much more diverse space.
I am interested in hearing a little bit more about what was happening in Billings around that time. You alluded to some things.
Yeah. So, yeah, Billings is a really fascinating space because it is kind of an amalgamation of a lot of Western industries. It's obviously in many ways a railroad town, but it becomes a major, because of the railroad, becomes a major agricultural and ranching center, which draw different types of jobs and people. And as the city grows, it gets, you know, pretty large and supports a whole class of workers and residents. And then by the 1920s and 30s, you start seeing oil kind of play a major role. And this, for Black residents, is a fascinating kind of and challenging, well, fascinating for historians and challenging to experience it, I'm sure, dynamic where the rest of Billings, as it grows, is growing largely north of the tracks. And this racially diverse neighborhood on the south side, it's a triangular kind of neighborhood district that's kind of abutted between the railroad tracks and eventually the refineries and then the Yellowstone River, which later on, obviously, there are health and environmental concerns that kind of play into that. But at the time, it was undesirable, both because it was cut off from the rest of Billings physically by multiple railroad tracks that did not have a bridge of any kind going over it, but also because it was downwind of the sugar beet factory, so it smelled terrible. And that polluted the Yagan Ditch, in which most people got water from. So you automatically, even in the late 19th century, see kind of the effects of environmental racism playing out in where non-white people are allowed to live in Billings. And Billings is an interesting case because I don't think they have any official laws on their books stating, you know, the presence of something like a restrictive covenant or a red line concept that we would be familiar with. But if you look at the census, there's not a single African-American person who's owning or even renting a home outside of this neighborhood throughout the entire kind of early history of Billings. So that's revealing, and kind of the proof is in the pudding that there was certainly some type of unofficial restrictive covenant in place. But people, nevertheless, have, you know, really vibrant and complex lives that are in all kinds of ways unfolding so that they can continue to make Billings their home. Especially by the 1910s and 20s, there are a lot of other options for Black folks in the West to find and make a living. And nevertheless, Billings and Great Falls, those two towns, kind of grow and thrive in the 1920s and early 30s, when a lot of the other towns in Montana are really struggling with kind of a large recession and a lot of out-migration of the Black community. One of the stories from Billings that I find just, it's kind of overwhelmingly powerful. There was no Black AME church in Billings in the 1890s and early 1900s, but there is a group of Black Methodists who are attending the White Methodist Church on the north side of the tracks. And after a while, the Black community in Billings is growing at this point to 150, 200 people. Many of them are, you know, members of the Methodist Church, and they say, we want a church that's not going to discriminate against African Americans in leadership positions or ostracizing us as part of a faith-based community, which on the surface claims no racial discrimination is taking place, but nevertheless, the full ladder within a Methodist and Episcopal church structure was not available to African Americans at the time. So they form an African Methodist Episcopal church, and they look to buy a building, and they're trying to find and pull together the funds. And in this story, they actually try and get a design built, which we have a blueprint of one of their original propositions, which is this really cool neo-Gothic church, which they couldn't afford in the end. But what they did find was an old salt box warehouse building that was 17 blocks north of the tracks. And the owner said, you can have it for this price, which the church could afford, but you have to take it. And because no one lived that far, you know, no one lived outside of the South Side neighborhood, the church community one day in August, I think 1917, they lifted up this pretty large building. They didn't take it apart. They lifted it whole off its foundation, put it on log rollers, and rolled their church 17 blocks down one of the main thoroughfares to where it sits now on the south side. So I can't imagine what it would have been like to be both someone participating in that, but also just a bystander, you know, a white resident of Billings looking on how they could have made sense of all the layers of meaning and complexity that would have gone into a group of people moving an enormous building into their neighborhood, largely due to the fact that they were not allowed to live anywhere else. So yeah, there are those kind of stories kind of pepper Montana's Black history, which are, it's fascinating and much larger than any one historian is going to be able to document. So hopefully we have lots of interested people over the next, you know, decade who are doing their own historical research, going to grad school, or just, you know, working and reading and writing and telling those stories for the first time.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. I actually grew up in Billings and I did not know any of that information. And I'm feeling like some sad feelings that we were never taught about this amazing thing that happened in Billings, mm-hmm. which honestly, that's like moving a whole building. That's wild.
It has a certain emotion that I can't get over. It's Wayman's Chapel, which is, it's a little white building, and I think it's still open. Actually, it closed down temporarily maybe a decade ago, but I think it's still an AME church. I might be wrong since COVID developments, but I think up to 2019, I think it was still an operating AME church.
Yeah, that's really incredible. Thank you for sharing that. It sounds like organizing has been really critical to Black communities in Montana. And I know you've shared already some examples of what that has looked like, but I'm wondering, do you have any stories about Black Montanans becoming really invested in labor movements? I know labor organizing was a huge deal in Montana, and I'm just wondering if you have any specific stories along those lines.
Man, yeah, there's a couple really good ones that are pretty complicated, but I think there's a shortened version of the story. One way to tell it might be to go to a place like Butte, where you would expect a story of labor organizing to take place. Obviously, in the late 19th century, you know, Butte kind of gets its moniker as the Gibraltar of unionism. But African Americans, as well as Chinese workers and a host of other non-white people, were fully excluded from the various labor unions that were really struggling with the Anaconda Company and the other kind of larger William Clark's company as well, over fair wages and workplace safety and so on. So African Americans seem to be at first glance kind of on the outside of the labor history of Montana. One of the chapters in my book, which if you get a chance to read it, but you don't like academic history, it's chapter 3 is the chapter for you. It's really not very academic-y. It's It's the story of the New Age, which is the black newspaper that ran in Butte in 1902 and 1903. And it is about this exact question. These two black men, one, John Duncan, was from an island in the Indian Ocean, essentially. So kind of part of the diaspora, but had not been naturalized until much later. And his partner, Chris Dorsey, and they wanted to be involved in the politics and the organizing and the labor movement in Montana, but there was no place for black men to do that. So they started this newspaper trying to drum up support during an election season right after one of the Copper Kings, Marcus Daly, passed away, and he was the head of the Anaconda Company. And it was so confusing. The politics of Montana was so confusing when he died, because the parties were really kind of split in their allegiance to these other, you know, millionaire and billionaire figures, William Clark and Augustus Heinze. And it was at a time where labor was not very powerful. So you really didn't have much of a choice. So unions were trying to figure out what to do. Workers were trying to figure out what to do, who to support, who had, you know, the best interests of a worker in mind. And it wasn't clear. And in this like weird moment, black Montanans, especially those living in Butte, really try to leverage their voting potential to convince candidates to cater to issues that matter to the black community. And it was a fascinating turn of events. What happens is bizarre and weird. The two editors actually don't agree on which party to support, the Democrats or the Republicans. The parties weren't necessarily associated very closely with national Democratic or Republican parties. Rather, they were associated with particular mine owners and policies, which shows how localized the interests of the black community in Butte was. It was about mining. It was about mining politics. That's what they cared about. And they really saw themselves as part of that community, as evident in their newspaper. The story that ends pretty poorly, actually. It doesn't seem that much heed is given to the black community at that moment. However, the wife of John Duncan, who's a wonderful woman named Armetta, she actually does way more than John ever could have dreamed. He started in a newspaper and was a doctor and was, you know, well known. Armetta did way more than John ever could have possibly imagined in terms of actually organizing and convincing people to take the needs of African Americans in Montana seriously. She was one of the founding members of the Pearl Club, which was the black women's club in Butte, which organized in 1918 during the First World War for a Red Cross affiliate, raising food for and money for the war effort. But by 1921, they joined the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs. And in 1921, Armetta and the Pearl Club organize many other clubs that are either already in existence, or they help other black women in the towns across Montana to organize, and they create the Montana Federation of Colored Women's Clubs, which was a phenomenally energetic and important organization in the 20th century history of the state. My favorite example of how interesting it engages with kind of labor organizing comes from Anaconda. The club that joins the Federation eventually, founded earlier in 1921, they were called the Good Word Club. I think it was 6 or 7 women in Anaconda. And in 1921, there was the bottom just fell out of the copper market, and the smelter in Anaconda, and thus 80% of the town lost, you know, went out of work, and just waited for the company to start producing copper again. And in that huge work stoppage and the strike that kind of precipitated it and went along with it, no one had any, you know, firm access to food or resources. And the Good Word Club was founded on the principle of just going around and finding out of work miners and giving them a meal, essentially, to help, you know, with them and their families for that day. I find that story somewhat overwhelming, because not a single one of those black women's husbands, brothers, sons, was a member of a smelterman's union or had any protections. And as far as I can tell, only one of the women in that group her husband worked for the smelter. All the rest of them did not. So they certainly probably were out helping the various, about a dozen or so black men worked with the company at the time. But for the most part, it seems like their efforts are probably directed at white smeltermen who are, you know, denying their own family kind of access. That's an arresting thing to find in history. And then you see their motto is that we only see the good in everyone, which may tell you something about their outlook. And if that was the end of the story, I think there'd be, you know, that'd have some layers to it. But the Good Word Club with, you know, over a dozen other black women's clubs in Montana organized, and by the 1930s and 40s, they start really pushing hard in the state legislature to get some type of anti-discrimination language passed, just so that kind of the ubiquitous experience of being denied a room at a fancy hotel or a meal at a restaurant, or being told to only eat out back, which was pretty common in a lot of different cities and towns in Montana, that they would have some legal backing to fall back on if they wanted to challenge this. So yeah, they start in the 30s, this group of women who are otherwise doing, you know, reading clubs and, you know, discussing various topics pertinent to Black history going on nationally. But they're also drafting legislation and trying to get representatives to put bills on the floor and take votes and get people on record. And this is all taking place, you know, a decade or more before what we would call the national civil rights movement. And in many cases, this is what the civil rights movement looks like at a state level everywhere in the country in the 30s and 40s, before it kind of gains the momentum of a national movement. So Montana's right there in the middle of it. There's a lot. I was rereading some of the sources, some of the letters that were written back and forth between the club women and legislators and opponents and proponents, and they're really fascinating and revealing of what race and race relations, if that's an appropriate term, I guess, looks like in Montana in the mid 20th century.
Wow, that's really incredible and fascinating, especially the Black women's clubs utilizing kind of like that goodwill, grassroots organizing, handing out meals in order to kind of gain political power, and utilize that to navigate some really, really, I'm sure, horrible systems in that time.
Exactly. Yeah. And I wonder how much fruit it bore for the women in Anaconda or everywhere else. You know, the women in Butte certainly were also working through an organization that was predominantly helping white servicemen. And it's telling, I think. There are some really fascinating exchanges. Well, most of the organizing is coming from Alma Jacobs, which is a pretty common name if you're from Great Falls. She was the first and only, I believe, Black state librarian in Montana's history. She was really incredible. And there's been a lot of work done on her life. And a woman named Ada Hart. And they convinced one representative, a Democrat from Great Falls, Leo Graybill, who I believe is from the same kind of political family that still is part of Montana Democratic politics today. He was the only one that put their anti-discrimination bill on the floor every year and fought for it and tried to get it through committee. And most of the time when we look at the archive of the, you know, the legislative sessions or the letters written back and forth, they run into kind of either outright racism or kind of more commonly a blithe, we don't need this here kind of racism that sheltered, made the, you know, the whatever lawmaker seem as if they weren't prejudiced, but they weren't going to say anything about, you know, racial discrimination on the basis that they believed it didn't exist. And there was one really great letter that the club women from Great Falls wrote back. The club in Great Falls is called the Dunbar Art and Arts Society. And after one representative from Bighorn said that there is no discrimination in the state and therefore this bill is not needed, and he killed the bill essentially that session, they wrote back as like, we'll have you know that last year when we were in Helena for our statewide conference, we could not find a hotel that would let us stay, and we were forced to stay in the living room floors of our members. So how about that? And some very, very direct verbiage and confrontation through the process. But they were still very, this is in the 50s and 60s when, before the civil rights movement, they want voting to be a part of it, but they're very cognizant that in Montana's past, the black community has always been relied upon by one party or the other as like a monolithic vote. Even at one point in this campaign, Ada Hart notes something along the lines of, you know, black people in Montana have had their vote for a while, but it seems to be the only thing the state wants of us. They don't want their voice. They don't want their opinions. So they were less at that time interested in pushing for, you know, concessions in exchange for votes as really trying to make sure that the needs and wants of the broader community were actually being heard first. But that's also a very interesting feature of Montana's past, is that African-Americans have always kind of been seen as a potential block of voters that both Democrats and Republicans pretty early on started courting, but never really giving any concessions to or any meaningful progress on various issues that actually mattered to them.
Yeah, I feel like that probably still very much resonates with a lot of folks today, feeling that way about both mm-hmm. parties that exist mm-hmm. right now. I know a lot of us are familiar with the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It legally prohibited racial discrimination in voting at the national level. What was some of the history around the enfranchisement of Black Montanans? Was it similar?
Well, so this is actually, I think it ties well with the story of the Black women's clubs. If you go back to the 1870s, Montana is a territory still until 1889, and therefore it's governed by the territorial laws in place. Territories could have made laws banning Black suffrage, but Montana did not have any such laws on the books, largely because there were very, very few African Americans in Montana in the 1860s after it became a territory. And then during the Civil War, being kind of associated with a Northern politics, certainly, it held off on any kind of racial discrimination in its legislation. And then in 1876, Congress passed, as part of Reconstruction, Congressional Reconstruction, it passed the 1876 Voting Rights Act, which essentially granted universal male suffrage in the territories. So Black men were allowed to vote in 1876. And that was followed closely by the 15th Amendment. So actually, Black men in Montana had the vote before, for instance, Black men in border or southern states or any northern states that still have prohibited Black men from voting prior to the 15th Amendment. So Montana has kind of an early history, but racial violence is also attached to some of the first instances of Black men trying to vote in Montana. There was a man, Samuel Hayes, who was killed in the 1870s during one of the city elections for trying to vote. Complex racial dynamics taking place there as well, largely because of Democratic Irish immigrant voters and kind of a 19th century racial calculus, which makes, obviously, I mean, it's illogical in its time, and it's even more complicated if you try to parse it out then. So racial violence accompanied questions about suffrage and voting. But really by the 1880s and 90s, a lot of Montana's Black community is really pushing hard on what was called a politics of respectability. That was a really popular political move. It was calculated. It wasn't always kind of accommodationist in the ways that sometimes, if you read into Reconstruction or post-Reconstruction Black history, you can find characters like Booker T. Washington, who seem to be kind of acquiescing to white supremacy at times, and he's often like pointed against radicals like W.E.B. Du Bois. Montana has a middle ground. They're kind of straddling that divide, but they are putting forward a very respectable, you know, character out into Montana's political world. And because of that, a lot of Democrats and a lot of Republicans see them as a large enough block of votes that they might win but not so large that if they alienate them, they're not really going to be in long-term trouble. So I think you get a lot of very racist politicians. William Clark comes to mind as perhaps the most vociferous racist that Montana ever had in politics. He's also considered one of the most corrupt politicians in American history. So he courts the black vote as well in Butte throughout the years, and it is remarkably disingenuous. And then you have people who are more genuine in their efforts, but it really runs the gamut. And this creates, I think, a pretty tepid climate for black political action. And it's really not until the black women's clubs in the middle part of the century that they start recognizing that, you know, stuff needs to change because we have access to the vote, but we have no voice. We have no one actually listening to many of the problems we have. So it takes a lot of effort and community organizing to break through a pretty stale, lukewarm political climate when it comes to African Americans and voting rights. And it changes after the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. There are, I think, noticeable changes. Great Falls elects the first black woman to state legislature. She serves for a term. And there are general, I think, goodwill efforts to talk about diversity in our communities for a while. But then not only do we leave my kind of time period of expertise, but I think we also come to a point where there's just a lot of disregard in the 70s and 80s around issues of race in America and in Montana as well.
Thank you so much for all of the context. I think I keep finding myself like absolutely shocked as like a young black person who grew up in Montana. I did not know any of these things, which is, yeah, again, just upsetting. But mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like voting in general in Montana has been like super important throughout history, but especially we see it like nationwide and then also coming back to like a really Montana specific lens. And I am just really curious about how voting impacted Montana's legislature and black communities throughout the years. I know you touched on this, but if you just have more like stories or explicit information, mm-hmm. I think it's just really interesting to hear.
Yeah. Well, I think that the black community, in their effort to create the space where people could hear them, dovetailed obviously with civic engagement through things like voting at local levels, you know, school boards, all the way up. But that effort, which the black community kind of had been doing for a while, that actually, I think, it did change the way that a lot of Montana's communities engage with politics for quite a long time. It's how you get a pretty diverse sweep of political opinions and administrations and a marbled, sometimes socially conservative, sometimes socially very progressive population. And in Montana's history, especially through the 70s and 80s, the new constitution mattered a lot. I would note that the one representative who actually listened to the black women's clubs and kept putting the bill on the floor was Leo Graybill, who I'm not totally sure if it was him or his son who was the president of Montana's Constitutional Convention later on. Nevertheless, it's like within the same kind of family story. Montana's Constitution from the 70s is a remarkably interesting, grassroots, progressive, common sense document. And you'd get a sense that the politics that is born out of a group of people who know that that voting only matters if you make it matter, and the organizing that goes into making it matter is challenging but necessary. That I wonder how much of the decades spent, you know, in monthly or weekly meetings or a coffee with Alma Jacobs talking about important issues and him actually listening to the extent that we can say he did, you know, shaped him as a political figure that actually mattered much more for both him and his family, who were, his sons were all lawyers. And I think his grandsons are lawyers as well. I think his grandson is actually on the Democratic ticket this year as the lieutenant governor with Ryan for the gubernatorial race. But nevertheless, he's a somewhat important figure in Montana's political history. But there are innumerable other people who don't show up so prominently that I still think, you know, matter a great deal because they are engaging with their communities and making sure that their voice is carrying beyond just their circle within their towns, kind of onwards and out. You know, Billings and Great Falls, both of them are really fascinating towns because they're kind of the two remaining large Black communities. Great Falls because of Maelstrom Air Force Base, and Billings, as far as I can tell, because of sheer determination of the people who live there to stay, which is interesting. maybe it's a commentary on weather or something, but of all the towns in the state where I would not expect a group of people to want to stay more than every other town. Billings, yeah, I've always chuckled at that, thinking it's like, man, they must really, really liked their neighborhood and their community, because I don't see any historical cause in the 50s and 60s for why the Black community would hang on and continue to come back and, you know, move away for college maybe and come back and live in Billings over places like Butte or Missoula or Helena, where the population's really, you know, cut by more than half or 60 or 70% in some cases from what they had been at the beginning of the century. I'm sure there's an innumerable list of stories and inspiring individuals. And what we need, maybe if I can give one, my closing call would be for people who are young or just interested and have the resources through school or the time. Montana's Black history is not, it doesn't not exist. Like, you can go find it. You can find it in archives and in newspapers and in family members and older members of our community that have it in their oral histories and their memories and recollections. We're really at an important point for historical storytelling to make sure that these stories. So Lila, as you said, that you didn't hear growing up, perhaps if we can get so lucky as to stumble upon maybe or fight for the better commitments in how we talk about our own past and the stories that we tell about ourselves to include a much more diverse scope of people and their experiences, that we need those stories to now exist and kind of be in circulation, be written down so that people can, you know, find them and learn from them and read them and be inspired by them and look for more. So that's my pitch, hopefully, for young people wanting to go into history, that this is an incredibly underdeveloped field of study, and there's so much more to say.
Yeah, I love that call to action, and I really hope that people will heed that.
Me too.
Along those lines, what are some of the lessons from the past that you think are relevant and important for our listeners today?
Yeah, of course. So obviously, there is all the important lessons that can be drawn from, you know, the need and urgency of organizing and the communities that really see themselves and their futures at stake in Montana that, you know, the previous stories talk about. There's also another lesson which I try to drive home in my book, and I hope that other readers who share my background as a white Montanan and occupy that kind of positionality might also think about, is that there still exists what I would call kind of a Montana racial exceptionalism, which really needs to die in all kinds of ways pretty quickly. And this is actually this opinion kind of shows up all over the place. It's, you know, white progressives, white conservatives, white moderates, you name it, you can find echoes of this exceptionalism. Black history can really subvert and at the same time uphold parts of that. So I think of the story, and this is maybe what I would end you with. There's the story of a young Black girl, Clarissa Crump. When she was 9 years old, her name was Clarissa Powell. She was enslaved in Missouri to a white couple. Her entire family, her mother and I don't think her father, but her brothers and sisters were all owned by this same couple. And as the end of the Civil War approaches and becomes very clear, they're in a border state, so the Emancipation Proclamation has not freed her. This couple takes Clarissa with them away from Missouri. And there's some ways to see this, but as far as I can tell, it still feels very much like kidnapping. They know that she is going to be freed imminently, and they choose to take her anyway. There may have been more to it than that, but it's hard to see that based on what happens afterwards. By May of that year, when the war does end and emancipation in the border states is declared, the steamboat that this couple and Clarissa are on is stalled on a sandbar just east of Fort Benton. And the story that the Crumps and the family that, you know, has lived in Helena for, you know, lived for a century and still tells the story today goes is that there was a wagon, you know, kind of riding along and it brought the news to this stalled steamboat and all the people on board saying, you know, the war is over. And this 9-year-old girl said, well, that's that. I'm free. Gets up off the boat, you know, climbs ashore, gets on that wagon and leaves and essentially emancipates herself in all kinds of ways. You know, it's a wonderful narrative. And she lives in Helena for a long time. She marries Howard Crump. And it's one of these stories that gets retold. But if you retell it to a white audience in Montana, there's the possibility that we hear it and say, Montana made this young girl free. And that is not the story that the rest of her life shows. She spends 80 more years essentially growing the women's club in Helena and organizing with her children, her daughters and her granddaughters and her great-granddaughters, who are so instrumental in the Black women's clubs, both in Helena and around the state, pushing for those anti-discrimination laws. They are part of those organizational efforts as well to take the type of action necessary to make her freedom worth something. And so I've always tried to use that particular narrative to say, yes, it's remarkable, it's inspiring, it has kind of a cinematic quality to it. She stepped off the boat. You can hear the symphony go as the wagon pulls away and she's, you know, sitting off the back watching this white couple who have owned her and her family her entire life, you know, disappear over the horizon. And it has the feel-good moment. And it was Montana that made her free. And her life of freedom and joy and happiness kind of all flowed from the fact that she got off the boat in Montana, which is not the correct lesson if you pay attention to the rest of her life and her life story. We need to remember that she lived an entire life in this place, you know, giving meaning to that freedom. And that if we just, you know, allow Montana's racial exceptionalism to stand, we kind of rob her of the effort. So my emphasis has always been, you know, Clarissa is incredible, but when she got off the boat and, you know, and emancipated herself in all different kinds of ways, she spent the next 8 decades of her life, you know, fighting and giving meaning to that freedom. And that it wasn't intrinsically bestowed upon her because of, you know, being under the big sky or whatever. And her life story is a testament to the efforts that everyday Black Montanans were, you know, struggling against and working towards certain goals and efforts. And yeah, Clarissa's story really does, I think, dissuade us of thinking of any kind of racial exceptionalism in Montana's past or today in its present as well.
Thank you to Anthony Wood. We really appreciate you coming on and sharing these incredible stories of Black Montanans.
Thank you for the work that you're doing as well. You know, I live in Helena and I want every opportunity for a better, more just, equitable community to take shape. And, you know, there are many institutions and organizations that are working for that. And you're obviously certainly one of them. So just thank you as someone who lives here.
You can subscribe to What the Helena on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. Bye.